Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What gives a popular musician enduring influence for decades after his death? Jimmy Rogers was famous for only about 5 years of a life cut tragically short by tuberculosis and recorded just over 100 different songs. But in the nearly 80 years since his last studio session, Rogers has been a touchstone for musicians as diverse as Louis Armstrong, Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan, Dolly Parton, and Beck. And given that broad impact on American music, my guest today decided to explore what made Rogers' work so important and how it has been received and interpreted in different ways by each subsequent generation. Music writer Barry Mazur is a frequent contributor on pop and country music to the Wall Street Journal. His latest book, out now in paperback, is called Meeting Jimmy Rogers: How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. Barry, welcome to Think.
Hi there. Great to be here.
You could have written a straight biography of Jimmy Rogers, but your sense was that has been done before and quite effectively by other people. How did you settle on this approach to his life and his body of work?
Well, once I came to the conclusion that another biography wasn't needed. Nolan Porterfield is much read by people for over 30 years, and there wasn't a whole lot of new life detail that was seriously important to add. But there was this question, which you just mentioned, which is, how did this guy get to be what he is? Somebody who changed music in so many genres, who's somewhere in the world, somebody's recording one of his songs today, one way or another, had so much effect on the way we think about pop music. How is that possible, this guy from nowhere? So I thought, why don't I look into that? I hadn't seen it done quite this way in any other book regarding pop music, and that was part of the challenge.
What's the story of your own, the blossoming of your own interest in Jimmy Rogers?
Well, I'd been listening to him for over 40 years when the idea for the book came up. I cared about him. He was among people that I'd had. It's always been the music that involved me. And when you say the music, you know, Jimmy Rogers is a touchstone in so many directions. It's a lot of paths crossed there. So I'd had my own interest for a long time. But it took more time to accumulate to even be able to think about this on my part. And it had the added benefit is by the time I got around to it, there was almost 80 years since Jimmy's time to begin to look into and follow these patterns.
So you open the book with this fabulous story of two highly unlikely collaborators on one of Rogers' most famous hits, Blue Yodel No. 9. Before we get to that story, tell us a little bit about how Rogers created the original version.
Well, the thing about Jimmy Rogers is people may know him as the father of country music or America's Blue Yodeler or the singing brakeman, but the fact is, the records that he made during 1927 to 33, they were all done in that time, over, you know, 100 of them, rapidly, had all different kinds of backing. He worked with the producer, Ralph Peer, whose life story I'm working on now, by the way. But in any case, there was a deliberate effort to vary Rogers' records by using different backgrounds. And there was Hawaiian guitars, and there was what we might call Western swing bands, and there were down-home pickers. And there was also jazz bands, jug bands, blues bands. There was a set of sessions in Hollywood in 1930. Jimmy was out there with Peer. And a broad succession of music that happened one after another got cut there. And one of these was a record with Jimmy and Louis Armstrong. Now, they'd apparently known each other somewhat. Rogers had worked the New Orleans to Mississippi area early as a performer. And the producer, Ralph Peer, knew both Armstrong and his wife, Lil, who's also on the record, from previous encounters. And they got put together. So we have this, like, the king, you know, the all-time king of jazz and the father of country music on this same blues record. And that is the background to it.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm. Along come a police, he took me by the arm. It was down in Memphis, corner of Beale and Main. He says, big boy, you'll have to tell me your name. I said, you'll find my name on the tail of my shirt. I'm a Tennessee hustler, and I don't have to wait. Listen, all you round us, you better leave my women alone. 'Cause I'll take my special and run all you round us home. Deodorly, deodorly.
That is Jimmy Rogers, Blue Yodel Number 9 with Louis Armstrong. How unusual was it, Barry, for a white guy from Meridian, Mississippi, to record with an African-American artist, even one of the prominence of Louis Armstrong?
Extremely unusual. Mm-hmm. There were cases in the jazz and blues world of integrated sessions, but truthfully they were usually kept almost secret, and it wasn't much discussed, and it happened sometimes names were changed, but something, you know, it's not like Louis's name was on the record yet, but Louis was just becoming a famous solo artist himself on one sort of level. What Louis was doing in Hollywood was stepping out from the bands and doing big club gigs under his own name. So there's a bit of timing there, but yeah, it was rare, very rare.
And so 40 years hence, Johnny Cash develops what I guess could accurately be described as an obsession with Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah, he really did. I've seen some of the stuff that he collected. His house in California, they had a whole room that was made out of, that was decorated with Rogers memorabilia. I also had the opportunity in a bank vault in San Antonio, Texas, where some of Rogers' estate keeps some of the stuff, scrapbooks of Jimmy Rogers, which I discovered the individual pages of it had been very carefully kind of razored out, and I discovered that had been personally done by Johnny Cash at a time when that was the only way to make copies of those pages for his own records. He was looking to play Jimmy in a movie. He wore Roger's own singing brakeman's clothes in a concert in Carnegie Hall. So he'd had this long history of obsessing about Jimmy, and you know, with the love of trains and blues, all these things, they had a lot of common interests. And on his TV show, he was introducing so many people to varieties of music, and one of the guests in October 1970 was Louis Armstrong, and they proceeded to recreate the number that we were just listening to for another generation of people.
Took me right by the arm, and it was down in Memphis, corner of Beale and Main. He said, now hey there, big boy, you better tell me your name. And all I could say was, yo. Tennessee hustler, and I ain't about to wait, I said. Now listen, all you rounders, you better leave my gal alone.
there we have Johnny Cash and Louis Armstrong doing Blue Yodel No. 9 in 1970 on Johnny Cash's television show. Barry Mazur, that is a very different take on this song. You certainly don't hear Johnny Cash with a very different sort of voice doing that yodel. But what is the meaning, do you think, behind this sort of more laconic study of this famous song?
Well, I focus on that moment. For a couple of reasons, which is what my take on Jimmy Rogers or my examination, you know, exploration of what difference he made was about, which is that the first thing that shocks people is what we were just listening to is as far away from us now, the Johnny Cash show, as Jimmy Rogers was from them then.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. There's a lot of time covered there, and things happen. And people's ideas of Louis Armstrong in 1970 or Johnny Cash's are as much different then from what they may be today as the ideas of what Jimmy Rogers meant and how his music worked, evolved over time. So I wanted to, first of all, do that. And there was another thing going on. I mean, you could hear there, even on just the audio version, it's very clear when you see them, you know, almost cheek to cheek doing it, that Johnny's yodel, Louis Armstrong's, oh yes, when they come together, there's this physicality, there's this nonverbal movement that matters, that reaches out to people. And in the quality of that, there's something of the quality that powered Jimmy Rogers across all this time.
Where did Jimmy Rogers learn to yodel?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, yodeling is one of these things on a certain level, like wiggling your ears, you can either do or not do in some kind of way. You know, you can try all you want for years, and some people never do it.
Mm-hmm.
There had been, and I think this is one of the things I'm able to clarify for some people in the book, there had been a tradition of yodeling in vaudeville in America that went back into the last century before. Black and white performers, by the way. So that it's a question of how you use it. To use it in the blue yodels like he did, where it's a kind of exclamation point. It was a kind of instrumental fill. It was all kinds of ways to use it. He yodels on almost every one of those 111, 112 records, mm-hmm. virtually all of them, and they're all different.
Mm-hmm.
They're used differently each time. So the yodeling, you know, people have yodeled in almost every culture on earth as long as we got history, but the Jimmy Rogers yodel was very specific. Became a hit and was massively copied and imitated.
What's remarkable is that he had lung problems from the age of 15, was officially diagnosed with TB at 24. It doesn't sound like he's having any problems getting a breath in his lungs.
Yeah, there's a lot of remarkable things about this guy, and you touch on something. Yeah, people don't make that connection that often, is that one of the most famous things about his style of performing, you might call a kind of breath trick.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, he'd been diagnosed with TB, which proved fatal, before he ever recorded. The entire time he was recording, there was the possibility of death looming. That was always there. And yes, he smoked for all that time, too, by the way, just to make it better.
Let's jump in here and take a break. My guest is music writer Barry Mazur. He writes often for The Wall Street Journal and has a new book out now in paperback called Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. We'll talk more about this in a moment and invite you to get on the line to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is music writer Barry Mazur, a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal and author of the book Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Barry, I want to talk next about a song like Tea for Texas. And Rogers, of course, was not from Texas, but it's still a song that you think characterizes his sense of being where he, being from where he was from? Can you talk to us about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first of all is, you know, it was officially called Blue Yodel, and it's an interesting one to track over time. I mean, that's the song that made him. It was the third, only the third recording he had done. It was the first of those Blue Yodels. But I mean, and it's a song that has, I imagine, a very large percentage of the people listening right now know in some version. Maybe it's his original. It might be something as late as Leonard Skinner. Or I mean, this has been done in almost every form of music that's come up since Jimmy's day. It's been adapted. Again, it's a blues. Yes, and he talks about Texas and Tennessee, neither of which, I mean, he started out in Meridian, Mississippi. Of course, he wound up during the course of those 5 years he had in his career moving to Texas. He loved the place. He had visited many times. It was, as somebody raised on cowboys, silent movies and stuff, it was a fantasy place as much as a real one for him. And he was under the impression, as people were in those days, it'd be healthier. Mm-hmm. The song is the one where a guy shoots down Thelma just to watch her leap and fall. Long before Johnny Cash was, you know, shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. It was an outlaw song. It was bad. It was violent and heartless. And it was a massive hit. It may have sold up to 1 million copies when the population of this country was a lot smaller.
T for Texas, T for Tennessee, T for Thelma, that gal that made a wreck out of me. Ole, ole, ole. If you don't want me, mama, you sure don't have to stop. If you don't want the mama, you sure don't have to stall. Cause I can get more women than a passenger train can haul. Ole, 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 ole.
I have to confess, Barry, I can't get enough of the yodeling. I have to let these things run at least until we get a couple of those. That was T for Texas by Jimmy Rogers. You listen to the vocalization there, and you hear, boy, Bob Dylan pops to mind.
Well, he's also somebody who listened very closely to Rogers and saluted him. I make a connection. You raised Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan today. I mean, I make a connection in the book. This very idea of a roots music hero, you have to throw yourself back into that time to hear how it hit people. And it hit them as hard and as fresh as people like Dylan did later, which is to say that people weren't hearing those southern accents. They weren't hearing the place that he came from. They weren't hearing rough talk. They weren't, the whole world that's involved in that song was not something that was thrown out in polite company. People didn't sing about it that way. Mm-hmm. So it was quite revolutionary, and it had an ongoing impact to try to do that. There were people who may sound very different who picked up on that approach. You know, you don't have to be doing a Rogers song to be influenced by Jimmy Rogers in strong ways. You may not even know that you were. It's so much part of America's popular DNA. But it's still there. Those people that we talked about are both very aware of it. Rogers would change costumes, hats, and styles. And anybody who followed the career of Bob Dylan over the years knows exactly the same kind of thing played out.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting that we think today of Jimmy Rogers. You mentioned that he is the father of country music. And yet when he was performing, there was no such genre. He didn't necessarily put himself in a box.
No, he had no idea. I mean, in his time, the phrase wasn't even used. If you had asked people in his day, you know, what is Jimmy Rogers? They would probably say, well, he's that vaudevillian who sings a lot of blues.
Hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, he set a whole series of patterns that eventually were really central to what became country music. Now, nobody called him the father of country music until 20 years after he was dead, not least of all because probably nobody really cared who was the father of country music until the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, and then they had to look at it and say, well, how did that happen and who best represents us? And he worked. But in his own day, though, you know, the Carter family, so very different from Jimmy, were discovered and recorded by the same producer and even were put on records with Jimmy a couple of times. But nobody would mistake them for each other. And most of his recordings were sold as down-home pop. You know, that was a new idea in itself, a pop music that took into account this localized roots music. You hadn't seen that before, really. And it's the start of something big.
Another fascinating thing that you did, Barry, for this book was you went back and analyzed tour dates, where he was in particular cities, and then you went and tried to find out who else was playing in those areas when he might have walked into a bar after his own show and taken in somebody else's act.
Well, there were times where that mattered. I think you may be thinking especially of the question of the great important blues singer Tommy Johnson, that people have always found a musical connection there, a suspected one, and they were from not very far apart in Mississippi at the time. So that was one of the things you could do. That I had to do that kind of research in some cases because, you know, there wasn't much coverage of any of this sort of music in the day. There might be local notices and papers, but there weren't national talk shows talking about roots music or pop music. There weren't newspaper reports nationally. It wasn't treated with very much respect. So there's a lot of research had to be done. And in the course of that book, I interviewed over 80 musicians from all those genres about their own experiences coming to this music and what they did with it. It was useful that there were so many musicians because some were around long enough that you could get a sense of what fans, people in Jimmy's audience, responded to. Nobody ever asked the fans what they thought of them.
And Rogers had a keen sense of what would sell.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was instinctive. I mean, it got to be learned. But one of the things that any musician would tell you to this day when I talk to is the sheer amount of meeting, to coin a phrase on the title, with his own audience that he did had to have made a difference there. He toured relentlessly, like in those towns you were just referring to. In Texas alone, sometimes it was 80 towns in 80 days. At a time, and this is the Depression, there were towns where people lined up four blocks long for a chance to hear this guy for a dollar at a movie theater at a time when they couldn't give away the movies for a dime and had to give away free dishes to get anybody in there in the same theaters. So that was the draw, and that was also, you know, he was, when I say roots music hero, the idea of this is that you're more than a star. You're more than a singer. You become a kind of unelected representative of the people you come from. He stands for you. And that was true of a Bob Wills. It was true. It's true of a Dolly Parton or a Sam Cooke or a Hank Williams. When you become bigger, a Bob Marley, when you become bigger than the music you make and you start to stand for the people you come from, they follow you avidly. Legends are knitted. And the other thing is they give you a whole lot of leeway to go as broadly musically as all those people did.
I'm glad you brought up Dolly Parton because, as comes up in the book, it seems that a lot more men have covered Jimmy Rogers tunes than women. But, of course, Dolly Parton has this fantastic recording of Mule Skinner Blues.
Yeah.
Talk about what made, I mean, vocally it makes perfect sense for her to do Jimmy Rogers. But what drew her to him specifically?
Okay, all right. You know, first the background about the women. I think the thing is, you know, he was doing a transgressive kind of music, and for a lot of years, the places where women like Dolly were going to sing him most, when they eventually got to it, was in country music and folk and eventually in pop. But the women most likely to sing like Jimmy were probably African-American blues singers who didn't need any help from him on how to sing it or what songs to sing.
Yeah.
In between, there was a lot of time, and there were cowgirls who picked it up, and there were people like Rose Maddox, who was transgressive and picked it up, and Dolly knew those records. It was almost a bet. She knew bluegrass, and there is the background of Bill Monroe's very important version of Mule Skinner Blues, which bluegrass launches off of. You can follow Jimmy Rogers songs and watch genres of music get born. Dolly had all that behind her, and it was considered almost a joke kind of a thing. Well, there's no Lady Mule Skinners. And to her, that was just a challenge. I talked to her. She said, yeah, well, then I wanted to do it, so I took it and I dollified it. Yeah.
That was Dolly Parton's version of Mule Skinner Blues. And just for the fun of it, let's go ahead and go back and also listen to the original version. This is Jimmy Rogers' Mule Skinner Blues.
Good morning, Captain. Good morning, Shine. Do you need another mule skinner out on your new mud line? Doodly, doodly, I like to work, I'm rolling all the time. I can pop my initials on a mule behind.
That was Jimmy Rogers' Mule Skinner Blues. You know, Barry, having now listened to three cuts of Rogers singing, it really goes to the point that you made earlier, was that there was yodeling in almost every song. They all sound so different. It's almost like he was working his way through the different things he could do with music.
I think, you know what, in certain kind of, yeah, he was a natural artist. And you know what? Artists who love what they do try stuff out. Mm-hmm. If you're a filmmaker, you make one of those and one of these, this time a musical. You know, there was some of that with Jimmy. He wanted to do it. And also, look, this was a marketed act who sold large for RCA Victor Records, and they wanted him to try out scoring with these different kind of things. If you take just that song that you just played, you just take what he did with Mule Skinner Blues, and there's this crazy guitar break in it, and it's a song about work. You could just take just that song, and as I say, one version of it is used. They're really useful, his songs and his records and his approaches. Bill Monroe uses it to launch the rhythms of bluegrass. You can take another version, and it was a song very often sung by Woody Guthrie, to the point that people in the folk world sometimes think it's a Woody song, which it isn't. And another version of it becomes the basis of Lonnie Donegan doing Skiffle over in England, and you can follow that, and everybody who became British Invasion, practically pop bands, were doing Skiffle first, and you can follow that line, all of which I do in the book.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Since you guys mentioned Bob Dylan earlier, and specifically that he was an admirer of Jimmy Rogers's, I was wondering if the guest has come across any evidence connecting Dylan's admiration for Jimmy Rogers with the really peculiar vocal experiment at a moment in Dylan's career when he released Nashville Skyline and Self-Portrait, two albums on which he sang in this very different voice than he's ever replicated before or since. This was kind of a higher-pitched, velvety, rich voice that maybe people know best by Lay Lady Lay. Has the guest come across any evidence connecting his admiration for Jimmy Rogers with that kind of vocal performance?
Thanks for your call.
Okay, yeah, well, you know, Bob was very much interested in trying out the sounds of more modern country music. But I can tell you one thing: there is no question about it. He talks about it in his own memoir that he first heard Jimmy Rogers when he was of high school age and was taken with him. There are recordings that exist of him singing it in the village with one voice or another. You know, Bob's voices tended to change like that at a very early date. You could certainly draw a line between Dylan's interest in Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams, which is a whole other place to go, and the fact that he would ever eventually do songs like that. Of course, he produced an entire album of Jimmy Rogers songs by other artists, the first time he'd ever done anything like that in 1997.
What was unique about the way that Rogers wrote lyrics?
Well, the thing about Rogers as a songwriter, there's a couple different angles here. On one sense, he's considered, with justification, a kind of a father of the whole singer-songwriter, gets up there with a guitar and tells you his life story tradition.
Sure.
He did that. The man had TB, and he would sing about it, honestly. He'd sing about his own life. And that's one thing he did. But with Jimmy, there's always other angles. He had many collaborators. Over 40 of his songs were co-written with his sister-in-law, Elsie McWilliams.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were, and some of those were about rocking and rambling and gambling, which is most certainly not her life. So, at one hand, he's the person who added to personalizing songs and bringing them out to people about his own life. On the other hand, he's an early perpetrator of co-writing Nashville style before there was, you know, before there was such a thing. And because he had a tremendous need for a constant outflow of material. When I say he did like 112 cuts in 5 years, you're talking Beatles and Rolling Stones level where you have to do like 3 albums a year.
Yeah.
He did a lot of songs and he wrote a lot of songs.
My guest this hour is music writer Barry Mazur. We're talking about his new book, Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Barry Mazur is my guest. He's a music writer who is a frequent contributor on pop and country to the Wall Street Journal. His book is called Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, where we find Joel on the line in Dallas. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
Great. I'm loving this show. I was wondering if your guest had pursued the influence of Lemon Jefferson on Jimmy Rogers at all. I know he'd mentioned Tommy Johnson from Mississippi, and given that Jimmy Rogers talked about Texas in his songs and loved the state of Texas and was contemporary to probably the most successful or commercially successful pre-war blues artist that there was, I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I can't prove it, but you ask a good question. I mean, the answer is almost certainly yes, he would have heard him. And for the reason that you're saying, Joel, which is the fact that Blind Lemon Jefferson, like a Ma Rainey or Bessie Smith or somebody from a slightly different blues world, was one of the really successful seller of records. Jimmy had, we know, a large record collection. Some of this blues stuff he learned out in the road, some of it he learned as a railroad worker, some of it he learned in the vaudeville theaters. So he was certainly aware of somebody like a very successful recording artist like Blind Lemon. The one of the interesting things about this is that Rogers is virtually the only white blues singer of that era who was equally influential in the other direction.
Hmm.
Somebody like Leadbelly or Howlin' Wolf were influenced by his singing. Wolf says, I took that yodel and I turned it into a howl.
Hmm.
I mean, he would volunteer this because people didn't ask. But I mean, so Rogers was in their record collections. It mattered to them in the same way that I have no doubt that somebody like Blind Lemon would have been in his.
One thing working in favor of a talent like Rodgers was that he came to prominence, Barry, at a time when, for the first time, there was a great penetration of recorded music in many American homes via phonograph. There was radio in a lot of places. I mean, that obviously made it important not simply to have the sheet music and play it yourself at home, but people began to associate a certain song with a certain individual's performance.
Yeah, yeah. That timing is really crucial here. Now, remember, he, like the Carter family and a number of others, were first recorded at these famous Bristol sessions by Ralph Peer in 1927. And this is a moment where you could be, first of all, you could be famous in a way you never could before. Yes, your photos are on the sheet music, but there was newspaper interviews with pictures. There was network radio starting at the same time. There were sound movies starting at exactly the same time. The film and the Jazz Singer, as Rodgers goes into the studio, and he's in a sound movie we're fortunate enough to have within 2 years. So that was one thing. And the other thing was the economic changes that were going on affected the interest in having roots music recorded. Black people and Southern whites coming out of World War I had some extra cash on hand, and the record companies and music companies knew this. And they only then began to make these records, which they saw as for them, in the sense that they'd already made records for other ethnic groups. They'd made foreign language records for Americans who spoke Polish or Italian, but they hadn't yet done much of anything in terms of records by African Americans for them. And what they saw with the Carters or Rodgers, which was music by down-home white Southerners for the same. In Jimmy's case, he transcended that market and was able to reach out in many directions as somebody like Louis was.
It's a little hard to indicate this with a clip on the radio, but talk about his physical stage presence. You've already mentioned he would change costumes and sort of personas. Talk about, though, who influenced his presence and who took from his performances on stage and incorporated it into their own work.
Well, this would be an area where it's a lot easier to see who was influenced by him than where he got them
from. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you would be hard-pressed. I mean, vaudevillians might do costume changes for the new act in 2 years. But this idea that Jimmy was 1 year a singing brakeman and presented that way and called that in a trainman's outfit, and he's in a cowboy suit in Texas, you know, 2 years later, and he's in a derby hat like a gambler, and he's in, you can go on with these different visual looks that he had. I mean, some of the poses and the way he'd hold himself, he'd sit on a stage, cross his knee with the guitar on it, or he'd put one knee up on the chair and put the guitar on it. People imitated this. We have a picture in the book of Gene Autry, who started out not as a cowboy singer, but as one of the many good imitation blue yodelers who would sit exactly like Jimmy did, so you knew he was a blue yodeler. People carried themselves like Jimmy for years, and it was, you know, it was in your face. It was a little raucous. It was a different kind of thing. You have to see that he affected people the way Elvis would years later. That is the easiest comparison to make.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Hi, dear. Thank you. I just wanted to ask your guest if he was familiar with the icon from Austin in the 50s, 60s named Kenneth Redgill, who was a Jimmy Rodgers. He was definitely a sound-alike and maybe just a copycat. I'm not sure, but he was really good.
Yes, I am, and he's in the book. And, yes, one of the threads, if you follow it in Texas. I mean, he was very crucial in keeping Jimmy alive on the Austin singer-songwriter scene and what came after. Now, you know, I get a heads up, you know, I get a leg up talking to people in Texas today, because even when Jimmy's music started to fade for a while in the 40s, say, it never faded in Texas, not least because it was taken up by Bob Wills and the Western Swing guys and carried ahead, and because you could dance to it, which in Texas always helps.
Absolutely.
But with Threadgill, you're talking about this other aspect, the singer-songwriter aspect, which is not for dancing, it's for listening. And yes, he was important in bringing Rodgers' music to a lot of people on that Austin scene. To this day, they'll credit him with that.
What role did his wife play in the rise of his career? She was sort of home while he was out on the road. And then what role did she play in the preservation of his legend afterward?
Well, very arguably, she played more role after he was gone than she did when she was around. I mean, they were. I mean, she was there. She was when he was home, which was infrequently. You know, he really was a rambler, and he was out there. But the fact is, after Jimmy died, she had a look at her life, and she became a kind of giver of artifacts, and she would sort of like knight people, his successors, of which the first was a very important Texan named Ernest Tubb,
mm-hmm.
who was the first real person, really obsessed with Jimmy Rogers person. I mean, she gave him Jimmy Rogers clothes to wear, as she later would Johnny Cash, and she would dub these people sort of next in line. It was out of sheer, there was a financial interest in having Jimmy Rogers songs continue to matter because the royalties came in. And you have to realize they had lived quite an extravagant life. These were people who, like Elvis, had a mansion, the Blue Yodeler's Paradise, outside of San Antonio. They were in Cadillacs. They were, so anybody who tells you, you know, people didn't make money in the music business, the answer would be, well, that depends.
Mm-hmm.
They also spent a lot of it. And she would... And so in the years after, she was very committed, seriously so, also, to keeping Jimmy's legacy alive. And so she was involved in the Jimmy Rogers festivals, which began in the 50s back in Meridian. She was involved always in encouraging the singers who would cover his songs and cared about him. And she was an important touchstone for a lot of people who lived a lot longer. She lived, many, many years, decades longer. Into the 60s, and Carrie Rogers mattered to people.
Are the artists who are paying attention to Jimmy Rogers, who are active and sort of on the charts today, do they discover him? Is it a sort of a hop, skip, and a jump? Do they find Rogers because they listen to Johnny Cash, and then they go back even further?
Yeah, it's almost always like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to be hearing... You know, today on your show, you can hear Jimmy Rogers on the radio, but mm-hmm. it's not like that's happening every 10 minutes.
Right.
It's hard to hear people from 2 years ago on the radio these days. So yeah. And for the first 40 years... Let's put it this way. For the first 40 years after Jimmy died, Tubb was probably the person most likely to have introduced people to his music by name. After that, the really big touchstone for a lot of people was Merle Haggard.
Mm-hmm.
Travis did too. No, Merle Haggard's 1968 double album of Jimmy Rogers songs was very crucial for the next generation and always referred to. And so if you see somebody like Brad Paisley did in the Jailhouse Now just a couple years ago, I think you would find that his connection was through somebody like Merle Haggard. There's always one, or the Johnny Cat, or Johnny Cash, you know. And generation by generation, it moves on. And as I say, some people are doing songs or playing riffs or striking attitudes in their music, which derive from Jimmy, and they don't even know that they are.
Let's just get a little taste of the original version of In the Jailhouse Now.
I had a friend named Ramblin' Bob, who used to steal, gamble, and rob. He thought he was the smartest guy in town. But I found out last Monday that Bob got locked up Sunday. They've got him in the jailhouse way downtown. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. I told him once or twice to quit playing cards and shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
You know, we haven't really talked very much, Barry, about the use of humor in Jimmy Rogers' songs.
Yeah, they're funny. This is the, you know, you can ask the question, how did he get away with all this at the time? he's thinking about vamps and Frankie and Johnny on the, you know, in front of church groups and look, he was a smiling, back slapping guy that people just loved personally. He would tell these funny stories between the songs, and yes, there was humor through it, and the joke was often on him. You know, you sing a song in 1930 where you say, I got a hold of this liquor during Prohibition. I could have been in trouble, but I shared it with a policeman and he left me alone. This makes audiences recognize what you're talking about there, you know, and there's a lot of laughter attached to it. Any idea that this was all about death and tuberculosis, about which he even joked, would miss the tone of something like In the Jailhouse Now, which has antecedents, by the way. It has histories in Black Vaudeville, that's some versions of In the Jailhouse Now, different tune, different words. And you can follow it forward, and that same song is the biggest country hit Webb Pierce ever had in the 50s. I mean, people still do In the Jailhouse Now, like Brad Paisley did.
So I'm curious, as you went through Rogers' music, and of course you couldn't limit yourself to just his 112 songs or whatever it was. Do you like the original versions with all the crackle and the hum, or did you seek out things that had been remastered and were a little cleaner so that you could hear them more carefully?
Oh, you mean the what version of the recordings themselves?
Yeah.
We Are Lucky to Live Now. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact is, his records from that era sound better than a lot do because he was on RCA Victor Records, and there was the quality state-of-the-art equipment of the time was generally used to record him, so they sound pretty good. But if you invest in something like the Bear Family version of it, which has been meticulously done, you're probably going to be able to hear it better now than they did in 1928.
Hmm.
So, yes, I have heard the different versions over time. I'm not a discographic obsessor, so I wanted to hear the music as well as I could. That's what I wanted to do, and I recommend that. And there are by now collections that bring together these versions of Rogers songs. There's a set called Sounds Like Jimmy Rogers. They're easily found out there for people who kind of like Google that up. To be able to trace the influence by listening is one of the things I try to do in the book, because each of these chapters, the chapter on blues, on rock and roll, on folk, on cowboy and western swing, all of these, they have these discographies at the end of them, so people can follow the records and hear them. People said, "You're breaking me with all these records I need to hear." I said, "Well, I don't know. I had to get them. Now it's your turn." You know, that's...
And there's even been punk artists who've picked up a little Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You could, this never ends, because there's this aspect of him, that was always, we could say this on the radio, badass. It was part of the act. And the punks pick up on that end as easily as, an upright bluegrasser might go in a different direction.
Music writer Barry Mazur is a frequent contributor on pop and country music to the Wall Street Journal. His book, out now in paperback, is called Meeting Jimmy Rogers, How America's Original Roots Music Hero Changed the Pop Sounds of a Century. Barry, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.